The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. In the paper, How Relevant is a Turing Test in the Age of Sophistbots, authors Dan Bonnet, Andrew Grotto, Patrick McDaniel, and Nicholas Papernat argue that the stuff of science fiction is here now. Namely, that society is on the brink of an AI-driven technology that can simulate many of the most important hallmarks of human behavior. They maintain that as the variety and scale of these so-called deep fakes expands, they are increasingly able to simulate human behavior so as to make the synthetic indistinguishable from the real. The events of the last few years have underlined that we are awash in disinformation, and that a large swath of society believes that disinformation to be the reality. But disinformation doesn't just include easily refutable assertions. It also includes sophisticated AI-driven technology, such as deepfakes, that are nearly impossible to distinguish from the real thing. Our inability to distinguish fact from fiction, the real from the synthetic, is arguably the seminal challenge of our age. Want more proof? Look no further than the events of January 6, 2021, when a rally of Trump supporters who fervently believed that the 2020 election was stolen breached the U.S. Capitol building for only the second time in the nation's history. Their belief that the election was stolen is the product of an effective disinformation campaign headlined by none other than the 45th president of the United States. Yet, this information posted and spread by social media platforms and bolstered by their algorithms seems almost quaint with what is already or soon will be at our doorstep. Sophisticated bots or surface bots that convincingly simulate human behavior, actions, and feelings. Ingenious deep fakes that deceive not only our eyes, but also our senses. So now what? What are the norms, policies, and yes, even technologies that can come to our aid?
Nicholas Papernat is an assistant professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the Department of Computer Science at the University of Toronto. He is also a faculty member at the Vector Institute, where he holds a Canada CIFAR AI chair and a faculty affiliate at the Schwartz-Reisman Institute. His research interests span the security and privacy of machine learning. Nicholas is a Knott researcher and was previously a Google PhD fellow. Prior to joining the University of Toronto, Nicholas spent a year as a research assistant at Google Brain. His work has been applied in industry and academia to evaluate and improve the robustness of machine learning models by using concepts such as generative adversarial networks. These are neural networks that vie in a contest with one another with aim of continually improving, and by deploying machine learning with privacy guarantees for using data at industry scale. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you for having me.
So the paper we referred to earlier in the intro, How Relevant is the Turing Test in the Age of Sophistbots, was authored by you and a few other professors and scholars who came from very diverse backgrounds, such as cryptography and AI, to geopolitics and governance. So what prompted this paper, and why do we need such different disciplines to help us tackle the issue?
Yeah, that's a great initial question. So when we all got together to write this paper, there was a lot of work around a technology called generative adversarial networks, which you just mentioned. And so what we were really trying to do in this article is to take a step back and chart out what can happen sort of in a couple of years or maybe if a decade or so as this technology becomes more pervasive. And so we wanted to see sort of if we think of this ahead of time, can we avoid some of the negative consequences? And can we set out the appropriate answers both from the science point of view, so from the new technology that we need to develop, but also we discuss a lot of the policy questions that are raised by these new technologies.
Cool. So if you had to summarize the paper, what would you say the key takeaways are that you would want people to remember from it?
I think the first observation which we make is that the example of deepfakes, which has sort of attracted a lot of attention recently in the past year or two, is really sort of the conclusion of a very long process. So if you look back in the 18th century, people were forging letters. So there's a sort of a famous example of George Washington having some of his letters forged saying that he doesn't want to fight the British. And then in the 90s, you had technology like Adobe Photoshop, where it became very easy to modify images. And so you can see the gradation where you start by not being able to trust written content, then it moves onto images. And so now in sort of the past decade, the sort of progress in computer science has made it possible to also modify voice samples or even videos. And so we're getting to a point where you can see that if we keep this logic going, we can imagine that eventually it might be difficult to distinguish sort of a real person from a synthetic person. And so this is what we call the sophistbot in the article. And so an example of this, I think, that a lot of us interact with daily is when you try to read reviews on the internet. So for things that you try to buy or things that you visit, it's sometimes very hard to tell apart sort of what is a legitimate review from what is something that another human has written, maybe paid by someone to do so. Or there was an interesting paper from the academic community that showed that it's easy to mislead humans with reviews that are generated completely synthetically by machines. And so this is, I think, a very common example. And so you can see if you take this example further, how difficult it would be to sort of know which of our interactions are genuine interactions with other humans. And so the first part of the article, we look at different technical solutions. So a few of my co-authors are also with technical backgrounds. So the first thing we try to do is maybe we can come up with technology that will address this problem. And so there we looked at a few solutions. The first one is obviously to try and detect the content that is sort of produced by machines. And so this is something that we can foresee because if you look at some of the deepfakes that are produced so far, they usually have imperfections or artifacts that you can notice as an expert if you take sufficiently long enough time to look at the deepfake, you will eventually probably realize that there's something that's not natural there. And so there has been a few results that show that you can sort of also train machines to recognize these imperfections. There's some examples, for instance, with body movements in videos that are not very easy to reproduce with the current technology. And so here, the first takeaway from the paper there is that if we take a step back at this line of work, the main issue with it is that you can imagine that as we get better at detecting content, this is going to fuel innovation in creating content that is better at evading detection. So this is not something new. And it has, for instance, been the case for long in fighting viruses and malware in computer security, where you can come up with signatures of things that you know are malicious, and then the malicious individuals will just adapt and produce new software. So
constant escalation.
Yeah. And this is even more so the fact with sort of deepfakes, because as you mentioned, they're very often generated using something called generative adversarial networks. And so the technology there is a framework that is designed to have two models interact. One is a generator. So this will take, for instance, random inputs and will produce what is supposed to be similar to legitimate content. So that would be the deepfake, for instance. So it produces a synthetic image, for instance. And then the second model takes images and outputs whether these images are fake or not. So you can think of this as sort of trying to counterfeit money. You have on one hand the bad people who are trying to make the fake money, and then on the other hand you have the police trying to detect what is fake money and what is real money. So this is exactly the same type of framework. And so the whole sort of community working on this technology is trying to get these two models to reach an equilibrium where the model that is detecting content is unable to tell which content is real and which content is synthetic. And so, of course, if we're trying to detect deepfakes, we're going to want the second model to have the upper hand and be able to tell what is synthetic and what is not synthetic. But the problem is that when we come up with better detectors, we can also improve the first model that is generating these deepfakes. And this first model will be able to learn from the better detectors that we've produced. And so you can see there's an arms race coming up where you can-
It's just a loop.
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
A loop. So they just kind of learn from one another, right? So where do you
exactly.
stop?
You come up with better generators, they produce better deepfakes, which you then get better at detecting, and then you improve the generator. So this is something that in the long run, we can't really expect that we'll be able to detect these artifacts. And so we should expect that the artifacts will even be harder and harder as we go through time. So this is
what
first,
do we do?
Yeah, this is
kind of reminds me of the arms race, right? You know, if you build better, bigger weapons, somebody else is going to build bigger and better weapons. It's not necessarily a deterrent.
Right. And what's even more concerning sort of with the deepfakes question is that the technology that is producing these deepfakes is designed around this arms race intuition. And so this makes sort of the problem even even more concerning. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So what do we do?
Is it mutually assured destruction?
So what do we do? Well, we thought about another possibility, which is that we would want to sort of be able to have something that is called provenance, where we're able to tell where the content comes.
Kind
from.
Of like art.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so here, what could happen is, for instance, you could imagine every camera that records a video will sort of sign this video. And then you can, as you watch the video, you can read the signature and it will tell you that this is indeed a legitimate video that was recorded at this point in time, at this location by this camera. And there, this is a solution that's sort of you could imagine deploying. And that we saw when writing the article that there were a couple of startups that were sort of looking at this space. So I think this is something that's being explored. Here, the main issue is that sort of previous efforts at doing similar things have been sort of difficult to manage in the long run. So you can think of different issues. So one of them is you have to distribute these the keys that will generate these signatures. And this is a problem that is very similar to how certificates that you use in your browser to make sure that the URL of a website is really giving you access to the website that you intended. So there is a distribution problem here where you have to manage not only the certificates as you add them, but you also have to be able to revoke them and so on. And so that can create a lot of difficulties around sort of the cryptography behind it.
Comes after assuming people are already adopting it, right?
I mean, exactly. And you also have the adoption.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, the actual industry, the video development industry has been doing that for quite some time, and they do it for a different reason, right? I mean, the motion picture industry does it because they want to be able to validate and verify the copies of material that they release.
That's correct.
It's a different distribution problem, right? It is a context in which it's much more feasible, I think, to distribute that kind of keying than me uploading, you know, video of my cat doing a really cute thing, you know. I mean, because the internet will be empty without cat videos, but
yes,
but it's harder to distribute the keying material.
Yes, And that actually raises another point, which is that you want people to be able to post-process the content, right? Mm. So once the initial content is recorded, for instance, you might want to show the video of this cat on public television. And so public television networks might want to edit the video, but you still want to be able to sort of verify that this is this is adapted from the legitimate initial video. And then there's also the issue that you could imagine someone very malicious and clever just play a video on a screen and then point a camera at it, which would give you the signature that you need to sort of
right.
Verify that this is sort of content that is quote unquote legitimate.
I call that the genuine fakes. Right?
Yeah, or the analog hole attack. So this right. is sort of like, yes, this is something you can't really do much about. So there are always issues sort of with these provenance solutions. And so we sort of ruled that out as another technical solution. So then we went to sort of the last attempt that we describe in the article, which is sort of the Truman Show. So here the idea is that if I'm a person that I think is going to be subject to deepfakes, so if I think I'm at risk of other people, for instance, if I were a politician and I suspect that people might try to produce deepfakes about me, then you could imagine that you record every minute of your life, right, on a tamper-proof camera, and you sign all of these videos with the timestamps. And there, after your sort of deepfake is released, you can say, well, this is not possible because at that time, this is what I was doing. And here's the video that I have as evidence that this is what I was doing. And
it's like there, body cameras on steroids.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we also saw a startup that was looking at that space. Of course, the issues here are the ones of privacy. So this...
Right.
This is very concerning in terms of having 24/7 surveillance. So this is sort of three examples of technical solutions. We try to be very sort of broad in terms of the solutions that we looked at, but it seemed like all of them had eventually a limitation that would prevent it from solving the problem from a purely technical perspective.
Right. And those limitations tend to be not the technology itself, but really the distribution of the technology, the adoption of it, sometimes the economic cost of it. I came across this one, I think it's called Amber Authenticate.
That's one of the companies that we saw, yeah.
That's right. It's actually from your paper. And where they, it's a tool that runs in the background on a device as it captures video. So it uses a cryptographic hash. But again, how many people are going to be doing that? And like you said, when it even if everybody does it, if it can so easily be gamed. But so there was another thing that you guys talked about, which wasn't the technology. So here we are, the technology that has created the problem, but it really can't come to our aid. You guys talked about some norms.
Yeah, so basically in the first half of the article, we looked at these technical solutions, came to the conclusion that eventually most of them will probably not provide us the solution. So then we looked at sort of more this from a societal perspective. And so here there are additional challenges. So there's a lot of challenges in this article. So the first one is that there is some research that shows that humans usually actively seek to reinforce their opinions.
Yes.
And also that finding unbiased information is difficult. And so this means that even if we're sort of trying to mitigate sort of deepfakes, technically speaking, there would be sort of this societal problem that adds on to it. So what we try to do then is to say, well, we need, as you just said, we need some normative frameworks to manage the malicious applications that could come from these technologies. And there we had a couple of ideas. So the first one is you could, of course, legislate and, for instance, establish criminal penalties for releasing deepfakes. So there, this really depends sort of who the malicious actor is. If we're talking about politicians, maybe that will have sort of a positive impact to sort of establish criminal penalties, because there would be consequences and these are public figures. So you could imagine that they would be more sort of concerned of these criminal penalties. But if you're looking at, for instance, state actors, right, then it's difficult to imagine that these criminal penalties would have sort of a an impact on them, because they would probably be hard to sort of prosecute.
But even with the politicians, if I agreed that I'm not going to use deepfakes in my ads, I could have plausible deniability, because I could say, well, you know, some fan of mine created a deepfake. I had no knowledge of it. And as you said, the confirmation bias of people really lends them to believe what they are, what they want to believe. I think Stephen Colbert called it truthiness. You know, it sounds good. I liked it. I like it. So it must be true.
Yeah. So this is great that you bring this plausible deniability notion up, because like in a follow-up paper on that I can share with you, essentially what we looked at is whether as the developer of a generative model that could potentially create deepfakes, what are sort of the things that you can do as you deploy your model, as you release it, to sort of obtain plausible deniability, mm-hmm, when someone comes back to you and say, well, your model was used to generate this deepfake. And so there are some solutions that are maybe not the most elegant, but there are solutions. One way is to say, well, if I use my model, I'm going to keep a log of all of the inputs that I fed my model with. And so what this means is that if someone audits me afterwards, I can produce this log of all of the inputs that I fed my model with. And so the auditor can then look at the model's behavior on these inputs and sort of confirm that, yes, this would not have led to any of the deepfakes that we're suspecting the person to have generated. Mm-hmm. Of course, this requires, again, that there is a framework for how you sort of put together these logs, and in a way that they cannot be tampered with, right? So you need some sort of, you could use more technology there. You could use things like the blockchain to make sure that sort of people are releasing their logs as they go. But there are certain sort of, you have to assume that the model developer will cooperate to some extent to sort of put those measures in place. But that is definitely one way to think about it.
I was actually just going to sort of roll this back a little bit. When we're talking and extensively about sort of hypothetical and, what could be done, what can't be done, what will happen. But I think it's worth spending a bit of time talking a little bit about what actually is happening now. I mean, even right back to your point about, forgeries are not, in fact, anything new. Everything from, presidential letters through through money have been faked for years. So A, it really is happening. B, it is happening, in the context of trying to be misleading and provide disinformation. It's happening with video. It's also happening, for counterfeiting reasons, pure financial motivation in the video realm. But sort of what else are we actually seeing today in terms of deepfake technology at play?
I think the main domain where deepfakes have made progress is, of course, vision, but also text. So I mentioned sort of the example of the fake reviews. I think this is one that we should think about. There's also a lot of generative language models that are being developed right now, where you can imagine sort of that you could generate news articles. And this is very possible. And there are already some websites that sort of produce kind of like automated news pieces, mm-hmm, where this comes up a lot, for instance, in finance, where you see a lot of articles generated just based on the recent stock market data. They're most likely not written by humans, if humans were involved, they most likely just provided the template. And so this is an example where this already happens, right? And the technology is definitely mature to produce those.
I actually saw an example of that on Facebook. This is somebody who, you know, is on my list, but believes sort of a different set of beliefs about the election and the breach. And they had posted a picture of one of these protesters, but they were all surrounded by cameramen as if he's being posed. So this was clearly a deep fake, and it was posted and apparently gone viral that, look, you know, this really wasn't a protester. This was Antifa or somebody else. And they were clearly being posed to kind of get this reaction from the likes of us.
Right. And there is also lots of sort of social network apps. We don't need to name any, but that have filters. Mm-hmm. Or that allow you to modify your sort of physical appearance. And so those are very widespread. And you could imagine sort of that being used for wrong things.
Yeah, so I was going to go back to your point about the automated writing of articles. I think I've read some of those because they don't read very well. it's like, this almost makes sense, sort of. Anyway, But I mean, there are contexts in which that's actually a benefit, right? I mean, it's like, you know, instead of just getting a bunch of stock ticker items with, you know, values and little arrows that's up right. and down, you can have something that you can actually read as natural language. Or so there may be contexts even where things can be faked, but you may know it and you're okay with it.
That's right. It can be useful sometimes. It can provide a service. So for instance, this could be useful. Sort of these technologies help also with doing things like translation and so on. So you could imagine also that you turn sort of an image into text, and this can be useful for people who are not sort of able to see very well. And then you could turn that text into speech eventually. So these technologies have, of course, good applications. And so what we're trying to reason about is how do you provide a framework to limit sort of the negative consequences when it comes, just like any technology, depending on who is using it.
Absolutely.
The consequences vary.
So going back to what do we do about this problem, you know, we talked about how there's technologies, but, you know, they only go a certain amount of way. And the human tendencies, our human tendencies to want to believe our confirmation bias really works against us. Now there's a lot of debate about who should we hold accountable. Do we hold accountable the folks who create the technology? Do we hold accountable the folks who provide the platform? A lot of debate about Section 230, which was the Communications Decency Act of 1996, which is really credited with, they say it's the 26 words that created the internet, right? It said, you really are not accountable for, the platforms are not accountable for any content that's being hosted and distributed by them. And we just saw with Twitter took away, you know, Trump's account. And previous to that, they would mark, and i.e. moderate things mm-hmm. that they said was not true. Do you think, I mean, that's not necessarily a terribly technical solution, but does that solve some of the problems that a technical solution was trying to solve and couldn't, you know? And could it scale?
Yeah, so I think the main difficulty in sort of automatically marking down sort of content is that, again, you need a way to automatically do this at scale, because you can, of course, pay humans to review some of the
tools, that can't scale. Instance,
but that's not going to scale. So I think a lot of platforms are converging sort of towards publishing sort of principles about sort of what is acceptable, what is not acceptable on the platform. And you would expect sort of that there would be outside input about sort of these principles. This is not necessarily something that, for instance, engineers should decide about. Mm-hmm. This could be informed by the law. This could be informed by researchers. But definitely having principles that are clearly sort of published helps, in my opinion, because then you know sort of where to draw the line. And right. It also makes it easier to enforce them and to deploy.
So you're saying that's a good solution, except it's not really scalable as it is right now because it involves humans. And you're saying that technology isn't there yet to, for example, verify, fact check very quickly. Because I mean, it doesn't matter if 5 days later we come down and say this is not accurate, because by then, like a malware, right? It's already spread. The damage is already done. So it has to be done almost simultaneously. And you're saying the technology isn't there right now to do that.
Well, and it tries, right? I mean, like Facebook has some algorithms that mm-hmm. will automatically not. And, you know, there have been some pretty famous cases where it denied access to people who were, some pretty funny cases where the algorithms tripped up in their interpretation of, you know, that's lewd content.
Right.
And,
right.
You know,
like birth control discussion about birth control versus, you know, pornography. Is that what you're talking about?
That kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, one of the things that I personally think would be useful is for sort of algorithms that surface relevant content to a sort of a tweet, for instance, so that you as a human can then go and parse this content and sort of make up your own opinion.
You're talking about opposing content. Like this is so-and-so said this, you know, here's a conspiracy theory, but another point of view about that same issue. That's what you're talking about.
Having sort of a breadth of perspective on sort of a specific topic being discussed, I think can sort of give you a more clear picture as a human if you are trying to sort of escape your sort of opinion bubble and sort of come down to the facts, because it's going to be hard for a machine to do that for us. So I think giving us the inputs as humans to do so is sort of a good way forward.
Where is your research taking you now? So you looked at this problem with a couple of different researchers and academicians from various perspectives, and the answer seems to be, well, technology could help us, but not really, because of all the problems we talked about. There's some norms and there's some regulatory things we can put in place, but that requires will, and that requires, you know, some unity, right? So where's your research taking you now, especially what you've seen now, the impact of this kind of misinformation campaign?
Right. So before we go into the research, I think one component that we haven't mentioned so far is also education. So I think general education is always useful. The more sort of equipped everyone is to understand what is being discussed, of course, this makes it harder for something to trend, even if it's not coherent. And another aspect that is sort of closer to my role sort of at the university is I think when we educate engineers, it's good to bring up these issues. So for instance, when I teach sort of the introduction to machine learning, I always try to include a few minutes where I explain sort of what are the possible consequences in terms of the security, the privacy, or even the ethics when we discuss things like facial recognition, right? We introduce algorithms that are very good at vision and so for specific tasks. And so I explained that if depending on what kind of tasks you're trying to apply these algorithms, the performance might vary a lot and might put certain people at a disadvantage. So I think just having this reflex as an engineer when after you go and work into companies is good, because you might ask yourself, well, should I even create this technology in the first place? Is it going to do sort of more good than bad?
You need to think about the consequences of a technology.
Right, because otherwise you as sort of a scientist or engineer, you're always very excited to create new technologies. And so it's good to step back for a few minutes or a few hours and think, what are the consequences of what I'm going to create? So I think that's one. And then in terms of the research, what we've been trying to do is develop solutions that are sort of hybrid between the technology and sort of the policy sort of legal approaches. So one thing that we've been trying to ask ourselves is, instead of trying to detect deepfakes, can we come up with technology that will help us attribute the deepfakes to specific models that were used to generate them? And so you could imagine this would be useful sort of to a forensics expert as sort of additional information that they can look at and say, well, I have this, I know that this is a deepfake, this video, I've identified it as a deepfake. Now, what kind of technology helped create this deepfake so that you can then sort of have a conversation and sort of address how to better protect the technology or try to come back to sort of the people who used that technology and sort of help with the investigations. So this is something we've been looking at, trying to, in particular, one of the techniques we came up with is we have this deepfake that we know is a deepfake, and then we try to regenerate it with sort of a set of possible deepfake generators. And when one of them is a lot better at regenerating this deepfake, then we can have some degree of confidence that this is probably the one that initially created this deepfake in the first place. Mm-hmm. This is one way that we're approaching it, but of course, that requires that this type of technology is used by people who are both knowledgeable in how deepfakes are created, but also aware of the limitations, because that process might not always work perfectly. And then something else that we discussed already briefly is plausible deniability, where here sort of we're looking into sort of cryptographic solutions for model developers to be able to record the relevant inputs that they use their models with, so that they have later on, when they deploy these models, plausible deniability that they did not generate specific deepfakes that people encounter in the wild. And so here the idea is to allow people to continue releasing models, right? Because one thing that's very good about the machine learning community is it's very transparent, the mm-hmm. scientific community. So a lot of the source code is available online for free on GitHub. And a lot of the papers are very quickly released before they're published at conferences. And so this is good because this allows us to sort of scrutinize everyone's progress. But it also means that sort of we need to have some countermeasures for people misusing the technology as it's released. And I'm not saying that we should stop being transparent, because coming from sort of a computer security background, I know that there is little benefit in trying to hide vulnerabilities that you've identified. It's always better to responsibly disclose them. So first, you notice something is wrong, you notify the people who are sort of at risk and the companies that are at risk. And then once they've had a chance to fix, then you go ahead and release the findings, because the bad guys will eventually find this vulnerability. So it's better that everyone is aware of the vulnerability and what it is.
Cool. Well, that's a lot of ground to cover. That's it's been fascinating half hour to look through the things that under the hood, if you will, at deepfakes and how to detect them, and some of where we're going from here. So I'm glad that you've given a pointer towards, you know, possible future improvements in dealing with this, because it was sounding kind of grim at the outset. but thank you very much.
We're always trying to find solutions. But I think this is when I give talks, sort of, about my research, this is the problem that I always use to illustrate that not all problems can be solved from our sort of academic ivory tower. Mm. This is a very good example where we need sort of the general public
real data
to sort of be aware of this, and to sort of make their own minds about how to best address it in their daily lives.
Great advice. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you both for having me.
Thank you, Nicholas.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.